This is Lewis Jukes, recorded at his home in Great Ayton by Chris Alden Lee on the 22nd of May 2010. Lewis Jukes, Part 2.
Okay, Lewis, let's talk a bit now about the work you did in the field, or your time spent in the field. And you seem to have spent a remarkable amount of time actually away from the base, which may, of course, was maybe because the base was in such bad condition. Or was it more positive?
No, that wasn't the reason at all. The reason is simply to maximise the time available in the field. Travelling to the mountains, well, first let's talk about the mountains. Halley Bay was on an ice shelf, and the nearest mountains, the Heimfrontfjeller, and the closest subdivision of that was the Tottenfjeller, were route miles, 290 miles to get there. And this involved a crossing of the rather dangerous junction from the ice shelf to the inland ice. So it was a major effort. And also, because we had tractors that could only pull up sort of 3 or 4 tons at the most, and that was a struggle to lay the depots and set us up, you had to live on what you could get there, let's say as much as you could be pulled out. And most of what the load being pulled out, of course, was petrol for getting there and getting back. So it was rather difficult, but we wanted to manage to spend as much time as possible. So there's no chance of coming back, say, halfway through. The pattern would be as follows, ideally. In early spring, as early as possible, when it was absolutely painful, you set out and you headed there, and with luck, you would arrive in the mountains just when it was comfortable enough to start doing work. So the trip out, yes, was uncomfortable. So we would arrive there. Say this was my first season, my first season in the mountains. So we would arrive there, and there was me as the current geologist and the previous one, Dick Worsfold. Now, the idea was that he would do a couple of weeks or a week or two, yes, of work, cleaning up just a few loose ends, and then he would return with the tractors. And then we would be left there until autumn came and forced us to go back to get the full time available. It meant we would miss the ship when it came in. So this could only be done by people down there for 2 years. In your 2 years, you only got one real season. But that was a way to do it. It worked, and it seemed great. I found nothing wrong with it.
Well, I've got some questions, if I may. I mean, we're looking at between, we think, 207 days, continuous days in the field, which at that time, yes, was a record, wasn't it?
I think it was. I know the year before they did 182, but we went out earlier and stayed later. We did, I'm not sure, it slips my mind. I've got it written down somewhere. 205 or 208, I'm sure it didn't end in a 7. Anyway, yes, but it was all work of interest. I mean, this occurred to us when we were thinking about station coats that we mentioned, because when their generators broke down, they had to sit there in the middle of nowhere for several months before a trip could be organised to get them out. And we guessed it, and sure enough, we learned that when we spoke to them, and it shows in their reports, boredom was extreme, and it was most uncomfortable. Never to us, you know. I mean, partly for me, the geology was interesting, but the assistants too. Half the time with Simon Russell, a radio operator, and then Tony Baker, a joiner, they joined in enthusiastically. You know, they were interested in seeing the work done. And if we got held up by if we were lying up in a wind, a blow, as we would call them, you know, there was impatience, but impatience to keep working. The interest was there. The interest kept it going.
So it just didn't get you this long, long period away from humanity?
There was one time when I felt I wanted a brief holiday, and let's say I fiddle things but it was just a short sledge trip in a day with pleasant weather, and I went off by myself and left Tony, you know, behind. I thought it'd give us each a day by ourselves, you know, but as much as that, that in 6-7 months is hardly a...
Well, how much of that 7 months was actual practical working time and how much was spent lying up? Half and half?
Hard to comment on this. My memories are that the lie-ups were a small proportion, and then when I look at my diaries, suddenly, you know, there seem to be a lot more than I remember. I think, I don't know, I would guess 30-40% was lying up, but, you know, my memory now, my memory is of the action, not of the lying up.
And you never panicked about being out there for so long on your own and getting back and being in touch?
We had a few frights and panics.
Such as?
Right. Well, perhaps chronologically, the one was when I hit my thumb with a hammer and thought I'd broken it. It was just badly bruised. It would have been a nuisance if there'd been a broken bone. I mean, we'd probably have splintered it to a couple of pencils or something like that, and it would have healed, you know, over the time. We certainly wouldn't have gone back or anything. Not long after that, I had a pair of sunglasses that I used to wear rather than snow goggles when I was on rock. I'd got them some years earlier. I thought these looked cool. And I was hammering away at some rock, and a piece about the size of a marble went through a lens. It hadn't registered with me. These things had got green glass, lenses, flat lenses, obviously. And I got splinters of glass in my eye. So I called Tony Baker, who was there, and he fished them out with a corner of my hanky. And he was sure he'd got them all out. He said it seemed to break into fairly big bits. He didn't think there were any small ones that he'd missed. But I was still pretty worried. Anyway, in a panic, I went up to the tent. It's hard to think why, but the tent was just safety. That was where you went. So I went there, and we got out the first aid bag, and there was a book there of instructions, and to our surprise there was quite a lot on things and eyes. It said there are three important things to do. The first, don't use a dirty hanky to fish things out. The second, don't use an eye bath. We'd actually got two. I'd got one in my own private little medical bag, and there was one in our own first aid bag. And third, go to a hospital as soon as possible. So we thought, well, that was two we were missing out on. We'd try and do the third and observe that. And that night there was a radio skid, and the doctor said, use an eye bath with warm, salty water. So we broke the third one too and did that. And the other thing that worried me in the medical book, it said the real danger with glass in the eye is actually a day later, because it makes tiny surface cuts and bacteria take hold, and you think you've cleared everything up, and a day later the bacteria, as they multiply, you really find out about it, and then you're in trouble. So I was on edge for the rest of the day, but, you know, had to keep working, no point in stopping. And even after the end of that day, I thought, well, there aren't many bacteria down here. Perhaps they're slow to get going, you know. So the next day, but after the third day, I realised I was okay. But it was a bit of a worry. And then at the end of the season, we were suddenly, there was soft snow all around us. And we only realised later, or we remembered, the previous year the people had soft snow in autumn. What happens is, I guess, is that as the sea ice clears, the sea's over 100 miles away, but as it clears, you get moisture, water vapour in the air there, more than usual, and the sea is only going to be at about 0 degrees. And then this air, you only need a wind of about 5 knots, and in 24 hours... 5 knots will have taken you well over 100 miles, and it will be with us, this moisture-laden air. chilling over the cold snow and rising up the slope. And, you know, it was so deep. We were 50 miles from a depot, and we felt that it wasn't worth trying to get there. You know, we wouldn't cover it while we still had food. A better ploy was to go on small rations and pray that it went. It did work, but not the way we thought. Firstly, we hadn't the discipline to cut down rations early enough. Secondly, it took longer to go than we expected. But it did go, and we had some worrying times.
Well, what about just the human nature side of things, with no fresh underpants, not having a bath for 7 months? Did that not matter?
It didn't worry me. It was part of life. I mean, you know, clothes got a bit dirty on base even, although you could wash them once a week. Once again, I just accepted that was the way you did. Quite how the others saw it. I think they saw it much the same. Standards change slightly each, you know, with different generations. Some of the earlier expeditions, not that many years earlier, you read where they didn't wash dishes. They just scraped things clean. You know, we always assumed that we'd got enough paraffin for the primus to have warm water to wash dishes. You know, but equally other things we did, you know, people a year later, they might have thought that they advanced ones, got more civilized one step beyond us.
Did you never feel vulnerable that you were so far from assistance, shall we say?
Yeah.
Or did a young 20-something-year-old man not think about that too much?
No. In particular, when the last tractor left, the ones that brought the goods out for our depot that would sustain us through the 6 months, you know, and they left, and there was this feeling we were on our own now. But it wasn't frightening. It was wonderful. It was exhilarating, you know. This was all ours. No, it was fantastic.
Can we turn, if we may, now to the events of the autumn, and in particular October, when you were on the Halley base and you were out in the field, and news began to filter through of a serious incident with another party and the deaths of Jeremy Bailey, John Wilson and David Marsh, who went into a crevasse
right
on a muskeg. Let's just go back a little bit.
Can I just correct you?
Please.
It was spring.
Of course it was. October was spring. Of course it was. Basically, McCotton says in his diary that he was a bit pessimistic about that spring journey before it even began, because of the tight timetable to get the survey results back in time to get them onto the relief ship. And he felt perhaps that he was pushing the men too hard. When the accident happened, he blamed himself. Now, yeah. Did you get any sense of that, any recklessness, should you say?
No, I would, with Phil, no. I think he did the best he could. If anything, I think he may have felt obliged to cover for Di, David Wild, Di he was known as. Di was one of his closest friends, and it looked as though Di was, to some extent, could have been to blame, and I think he might have felt that there was a degree of covering needed. But as for the other, no, he obviously felt guilty. It happened on his watch. But I think there were so many pressures on him to go the way he did. You know, yes, he was running things close to the edge, but everyone did. The first people who went to the mountains, Otis and Johnson, they depoted their radio to save weight because they knew that if they got there, nothing could be done to help them anyway. They were on their own. They went out there and they reached there, recorded it, and the plans were made for future work. It was a similar one a year later to the mountains to the north, Westfjella. Blundell and Winterton went there, and once again, you know, they were beyond the limit of any support that could have been given.
So we were still very much in the heroic era where risks were taken and bravado was still acceptable, was it?
Yes, I mean, obviously caution was needed to some extent. But yes, you pushed things to the very limit. That's how you got there. And or let's say that was the example that you saw if you looked to the past. And certainly if Phil had said, look, I don't think things are, I think we ought to call this off, he'd have been called a coward by everyone, including me.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So, you know.
Peer pressure.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Would have been muttering about, And the other thing, Bass had sent down surveyors, they'd sent down a geologist, they'd sent down instructions for a field program. If he was looking for guidance from Bass on whether it was doable or not, they clearly, we hope they read the reports, they clearly thought that what he'd got was enough to carry out such a program. It would have looked as though he was falling short of everything if he'd called back. The one thing that might have done it was that the mechanics advised that the tractors were not up to it. The tractors were showing their age. But there were two ways of looking at this. In the one hand, you could say that they were clapped out. On the other hand, you could say that they were well tried. We'd found what their weaknesses and found ways around them. They had made half a dozen trips out to the mountain successfully. We knew how to do it. No, he was in a very difficult position.
Can you take me through the sequence of events as you recall them from your perspective? Starting with the fact, I believe, that there was a decision to divide the exploration party into two groups, and you were in the other group.
Right. From the start, we had known, those who calculated the petrol, I rather kept out of that. It was largely Di and Phil Cotton who did this. I was in on it a little bit, but my heart wasn't in it. And the mechanics, I think, the tractor men, were a bit resentful that they weren't consulted because they would have put a more pessimistic view on it. Anyway, so we thought that improvisation would be necessary when we got there, depending on how much petrol there would be when we got to the mountains. Now, we approached them heading eastwards, roughly, and the mountains, that Heimerfrontfjeller run roughly east or northeast from there where we arrived. And we, in the previous years, we'd been working along them. And the area where I wanted to finish off, as Dick Worsfold had the year before, I would have a week or two to finish off. And that was at the very far end. So I would be continuing almost eastward. At right angles to this, north or even slightly northwest, was Vestfjeller. Now, that was where Ian Ross, the other geologist, was going. So, yes, the party had to divide, and the surveyors were going to carry on up Heimerfrontfjeller as I was. So we reached Pyramid Rocks, which was the first depot in the mountains, and several things happened. One tractor was already giving trouble, using too much oil, and the clutch was in trouble. And another one, the universal joint on the drive shaft broke within about a mile of the depot. It got that far. They actually used the other two to tow it there. So they replanned. They had planned that two tractors would head northish to Vestfjeller. Now, Dye's original plan, which I thought was a bad one and Simon Russell thought was a bad one, was they would go all the way to Vestfjeller, because near Vestfjeller was a crevassed zone. And Dye's view was that if he kept east, the further east you went, the more it petered out. I had seen it from a distance. Simon Russell had sledged over it with him, and both of us thought that was pushing the luck. Anyway, we decided that was out. It would be one tractor and would stop short. It would not go over any crevasses. Now, this route was thought to be completely clear of crevasses. It was the way that Di Wild and Simon Russell had travelled to and from Vestfjeller the season before. So it would be safe to go with one tractor only. Meanwhile, I could do my geology at the far end, and so with a team of dogs, not my old team, the Hairy Breeks, I think it was, which did I have? I think it was the Beatles.
I'm sure you're right, that's correct, yes.
I've forgotten that, I'd have to check. I went with Rod Rees-Jones. Mm-hmm. Oh, they wouldn't pull. We had trouble here and we had trouble there. And, you know, it was something that I couldn't believe. I thought only happened to beginners because, you know, the year before, with Hairy Breeks, everything had gone well. And we were supposed to be towing stuff. Anyway, moving stuff for depots. And anyway, we got there. And what I wanted to do, my last task, I was still looking for plant fossils. And thinking about where we'd been the season before, I thought there was one area that looked promising. And I thought, if we find them anywhere, they'll be there. So we went there. And it was at the top of a big mountain, so we camped at the bottom and we sort of climbed about 1,000 feet or something and walked along, and we actually found these things. And yippee, we came back with our rucksacks loaded up, and the next day we were going to, you know, really thrash it and perhaps even move the tent up. We got back for the sked, and that's when we heard about the accident, which came in very faintly because we had the 119 set, which was more powerful. A 68 set came in. In fact, when first we heard it, I didn't realize what it was, and I kept transmitting over it, and the base had to tell me to get off. So we were asked to go back, and you know, when we heard what had happened, I said, look, if they've died, we can't change it. Can we have another day just to, you know, because we might never get here again? No, everyone had to go back.
This was Phil Cotton's decision, was it?
I think it was Phil Cotton. It was the right one, you know, but it disappointed me. We made fantastic time back because we were now travelling downwind and there was a blow and we put up the tent as a sail. And, you know, we really covered some ground. We and the dogs were exhausted when we got there. But we got to Pyramid Rocks. Now, what had happened... The people who set out heading north towards Westfjella, the first day they did about 12 miles and camped. The next day they had a long run and they were doing what we call towing the dogs. The dogs were clipped to a rope between two sledges and the tractor load. The dogs still had to run all the way, but they didn't have to pull any load. And near the end, as you know, the tractor dropped down a crevasse, which... there was not supposed to be on this route. Ian Ross had not done much with dogs. He had been a tractor driver on the way out. Didn't think this was a good idea. I didn't think, you know, it was disastrous, but I just thought it wasn't the best way of doing things. Mm-hmm. I thought he ought to be learning dogs. Dogs were part of his geological equipment as much as his hand lens and his hammer. And... he now tried to drive back with the dogs, and the dogs didn't accept him as a leader, and everything went wrong. They wouldn't go. At last, Bodak, the leader, decided to accept him, and a couple of the troublemakers just beat him up instead, and Ian didn't know how to stop fights. And anyway, in the end, he managed to get them back, but it took him about 3 or 4 days. Then the only radio that they had working was a 68 set, and they couldn't get through easily. But when he got there, he found the tractor mechanics who were working on the tractors, and he told them the story. So now at last they got through with the 68 set, but the reception was so poor that basically it came down to the people on base asking them questions, and they would just send CCC for correct, you know, rather than try and send much information. Now, we were told to come back. Now, Rod Rees-Jones and I were probably, I don't know what, 80-something miles, 80, 90 miles away. Jeff Lovegrove and Tony Haynes, they were at the other depot, Bird Rock, halfway along. about 50 miles away. And so although they were told to stay and wait for us, they thought better if they got going, because otherwise it would be a shame if they held up the party. So they set off back, and they got back, and Ian told them the story. A day later, Rod and I got back. So by that, when we heard the story from Ian, it was the third time he'd told it in about three or four days. And from what I gather from the others, you know, the story that they heard was the same as they'd heard before, but it got slightly shorter, which is understandable. I certainly had been worried about Ian's mental state, you know, after what he'd been through. You know, might he be in some sort of, you know, nervous condition? Absolutely not. You know, he just behaved absolutely normally. Anyway, so he told the story of it. We went there following the tracks, which was easy. And anyway, there was the tractor down, and Doug Beebe, who'd got climbing experience, he went down on a rope and to see what he could recover. And there were bits and pieces. There was a bit of equipment, some of Jeremy Bailey, he'd been doing ice depth radar, a part of this electronic equipment. What we'd really hoped for, Di Wilde's survey results. He kept them all in a leather satchel that he took everywhere with him. And we knew that was in the tractor, but it was invisible and the whole thing was crushed, you know, and there was no way it could be. So the work would have to be redone. And that was it. You know, the three bodies were crushed there. And anyway, Doug Beebe then came out. Now, you know, there was people belaying him from above. We got beams over the crevasse as a bridge so we could run back and forth. There was all sorts. He did have a struggle coming back up, and at one point part of the bridge fell down and bopped him on the head, one which he didn't like. Because, of course, the question was, could Ian have gone down there, you know, to try and help Jeremy Bailey? And the answer...
At the time of the accident.
Yes, right, at the time of the accident. And
Jeremy didn't die straight away, did he? He was the one that lived for a
while.
Yes,
we'll just come back to that in a minute. You know, he could perhaps have gone down. I frankly doubt whether he'd have been able to get back up. Getting out of a crevasse is very difficult. You know, ropes cut into the side, you know, bridges fall back onto you and all sorts of things. There's a good chance he would have died if he'd gone down. Yeah, sorry, so shall I go back to... Of course, we only have Ian's account. And now we have to assume that it was true, but I've got several reasons for believing that, because, you know, I did consider that at the time. Basically, one person was staying out on the sledge to watch the dogs, because when they were being towed, as we called it, if one stumbled, it would be dragged along and could be injured, or the others might attack it. At that point, the person watching would wave frantically. The driver would see in the rearview mirror and would stop. It was Doc John Wilson's turn to be outside. Now, John Wilson was always cold, rather as I was, actually, the year before. And he was feeling uncomfortable and not happy about staying out. And Ian said, oh, he was all right. He would stay out and do another one. He felt comfortable. And also, they were passing about 5-8 miles from what's now called Manifalknauzana, what we called Stellanunnataks. And he wanted to just look at those and see what the, you know, if he could see any geology. Anyway, they started off and they soon coasted to a halt, and of course he stood up to see what was happening, and the tractor had gone. And what he could see had happened, it had gone halfway across, and then the rear end had broken and had dropped down. It had broken away from the A bar on the front sledge, which should have, one would hope that might have held it, but it didn't. The tractor dropped backwards. Now, we had two kinds, one with the original low cab and one which with a high Bass design cab, which is very useful. You could have camped in them effectively. but it was fairly flimsy, and it just crushed forward as the crevasse narrowed and squashed everything inside it, until it got so far down that, and the crevasse was narrowing, you got to the incompressible things like the substructure, and that's where it wedged. The front sledge continued, slid over the rim, but the A-bar impaled on the far wall of the crevasse, and so it stopped there. Anyway, he rushed up and looked down, and his first thought was to throw a rope down. He grabbed a climbing rope, tied a loop on the end, and looked around for something to hook it to, and there was a what we call a pigtail, a curly piece of metal for hooking ropes to, on one of the Mordheim sledges. Now, of course, the front one was precarious there, on the edge of the crevasse. If that slipped, it might take the next one over. But he wasn't thinking clearly. He put it on this loop he'd tied on the pigtail and threw the end down of this coiled climbing rope down the crevasse. And as it dropped down, each coil flipping clear of the coils, the last one, as it flipped, it just lifted the loop off the pigtail, not loop and all vanished down, and he'd lost his climbing rope. Anyway, around about then, the sledge that was wedged on the lip shifted, and he realized he'd better move other things, so he quickly moved the dogs and the tent and things in case everything else went down. And he kept going back and shouting, and that was when Jeremy shouted that he was alive, and shouted back that he was, and Ian said something about, hey, I'll come down and help you. And Jeremy said, no, I'm all smashed up, get out and save yourself. It's all written down. There's no point in my trying to give those again. But anyway, the gist of it was that it wasn't worth it. And, and he asked about Di, and Di was also dead. And he still kept saying things like, I'll do something, and, but to be honest, he wasn't quite sure what, and where would he moor it, and because from the tops, this was on a bit of a slope, the best way to go might have been from the other side, and how could he safely get across the crevasse and all sorts. Anyway, suddenly Jeremy started coughing and choking and gurgling at dreadful sounds, and this carried on for a minute or something, vanished, and that was the end. There was no more. Obviously the shouting up, the effort was too much and triggered something off. Anyway.
That's the story you heard from...
That's as we got it from Ian Ross.
How was that at the time?
How was what?
Listening to that story at the time.
I'm afraid I just took it as it was. I mean, I didn't burst into tears or anything. I knew by now we'd been sledging hard, and knowing that they were dead, we'd heard it. It was upsetting, but, I suspect if their spirits could have sent a message down, the message would have been, keep on with what you're doing, carry out the task that we would have done. But just another point, was Ian telling the truth? Now, if he'd been wanting to change things, for a start, that about losing the climbing rope, it showed he was in a state of blind panic. He could have left that out, but he left it in. Now, if he was trying to ease people's feelings, he wouldn't have mentioned that about Jeremy living on. I think, no, if he wanted to change it, the obvious things were not changed. And also, there was nothing that we could see there, no signs. He had no hesitation about the idea of going back. It wasn't as if we were going to see something that he hadn't mentioned. So, I'm convinced that his description is accurate.
Was there the wrong thing? I want to use the phrase post-mortem, but that implies a physical one.
No.
Was there a discussion afterwards about why it happened and what could be done to prevent it from happening again?
I don't think there's a question of preventing it again. I mean, I think these things are such a one-off. There was a question of why, because this was thought to be a crevasse-free route as plotted by Dai. Now, later, one thing that was speculated was that it might have been a failure to allow for the magnetic declination, that it may have been following a compass course, whereas the bearing was a true one. The difference was 11 degrees, and this puts you quite a few miles across. Now, later in the season, when we got back to the base, Rod Rees-Jones was clearing out the survey things, and he found some of Dai's, you know, going through his notes and papers, and there was a map with the route plotted, and the true bearing shown was the magnetic bearing that had been followed. So it does look as though that was not the cause of the accident. That was the cause of being on a route where there were crevasses. The cause of the accident was that they didn't see the crevasses, because when they stopped that time that I mentioned, you know, and changed people on sledges and so on, and also where they put in a route marking flag, if you looked around, you could actually see the first of this family of crevasses off to one side. And, you know, so they were too much in a hurry that way, and they were too, they weren't
observant enough.
You could say, of course, that if they thought they were on a safe route, there was no need to do so. But, very often accidents need several causes. One isn't enough, and something else will act as a safety check. But, yes.
In The Vice of Men, Fuchs goes on to say that one of the reasons for one of the contributing factors, they didn't run the dogs in front of the tractor. That if they'd run the dogs in front of the tractor, the dogs would have found the crevasse first, or indeed have refused to go because conditions were so poor. But it seems, from what you were saying and other accounts, that it was common practice to run the dogs after behind the tractor.
Yes.
Behind the landscape.
The first thing is you have to take great account of your situation. In some situations you do one thing, in others you do another. On the inland ice, travelling to the mountains, you know, a couple of hundred miles of just sort of open, not much happening, yes, we towed the dogs, as we called it, having them run, pulled by the tractor effectively. And we travelled in whiteouts and so on, in poor visibility, because it was a flag route and we knew there were no crevasses. One brief spot just after Depot 240, there were a few crevasses, and everything changed. Dogs were unhitched, they travelled separately, careful examination of the ground. I don't remember whether the dogs always travelled ahead then, because it was a known route, but it was a known crevasse route, you see. So you had adapted your behaviour and your techniques to what the situation was, and they were running the normal routine for a crevasse-free route, and that was the problem, that it wasn't a, you know, that they were off it.
They weren't alert because of that.
No, but also they weren't on the route they thought they were, probably because of the magnetic declination that had been overlooked. But had they been where they thought they were, they were using the correct routine. And as Fuchs... Fuchs was a great individualist. We used to ask, does he read reports? He did read reports. You find handwritten comments on them. I don't think he took in what was there. He just sort of fitted that to his views. He's written in half a dozen places about how his dog had supernatural powers. Darkie could detect crevasses. And not just that other huskies could. He describes specifically how Darkie finds them, others don't. Equally, when there are shadows or lines on the snow that aren't crevasses, Darkie knows to ignore them, and other dogs jump away in alarm. This is only in the Antarctic. Once it's no longer dangerous, when they're in Cambridge, when he took Darkie back, Darkie then panics at the sight of lines on the road. he's allowed to be fallible when it's safe, but in the Antarctic, you know, he assumes that dogs were magic, or lead dogs, his was magic. That is not so.
What are your memories of Jeremy Bailey and Di Wild and John Wilson? What sort of chaps were they?
Right. A base that size, 32 people, it's big enough for you to gravitate into groups, you know, of your own. You have closer and less close friends without, you know, needing any enmity or anything. Jeremy Bailey was not in my group. It'll be interesting if you interview any people from our time to see how they describe me. I was very naive and childish, you know, in my behaviour as well as my attitudes. And I think one or two, you know, found that a bit much. Fortunately, there were a few others who were perhaps similar, you know, so I got on. he was rather more sophisticated. Like Rod Rees-Jones, he too. And for that matter, Doc John. So he wasn't a close friend. Di Wild was a very close friend because we'd been in the field together. His image, he liked an image of rough, ready, you know, when work was to be done down the toilet shaft, you know, which was a pretty mucky job. He eagerly volunteered for that, you know, it was in his image. He liked to show that he was slap happy. He was in charge of the trip out to the mountains. But, you know, he didn't. Let's say, when safety was necessary, you know, he did it. That group of crevasses that I mentioned, you know, he specifically changed routines as should be done. But that was certainly, you know, the image that he gave. John Wilson... I think here perhaps some of us thought doctors are doctors, they're all the same. The year before it was Gordon Bowra, who was out there as an assistant. And he was a fairly robust fellow and very manual. You know, I can remember seeing him with the carpentry tools cheerfully fitting out his new surgery in the new office block. You know, a very practical fellow. John Wilson was rather more sensitive and nervous, and I don't know that he was the best person to send out there. I hoped he'd pick up as I did. Once or twice going out, I was exceedingly cold and unhappy about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was only for a day or two. The rest was fantastic. And I hoped that he would, you know, suddenly find how wonderful it was, just as I had. But yes, he was cold and miserable for quite a bit of the journey. And that, as I said, was what put him in the cab on that last shift. Jeremy Bailey, brilliant fellow, as I said, very sophisticated. If anything, I slightly resented him. He was too modern. You know, to me, the Antarctic was driving dogs, you know, and living on meat bar and doing it the rugged way. He wanted to make the most of what new technology offered. He could use transistors. Wow, you know, not just valves in his electronics. That was modern. You know, and to be honest, it startled, or not startled, let's say I had to revise my views, you know, when I heard about him calling up to Ian. You know, to me before then, heroism in the Antarctic was how many miles you'd covered with a dog sledge, or how many days you'd been out in your tent, you know. But, you know, what he did there, telling Ian not to come down, I put that higher, than Oates going out and leaving Scott and his lot. You know the details of that one, I presume. Now, I mean, Oates, the winter before he had, and this is in Ponting's book, he records this, he'd said that if any of them was a drag on the others, he should be given the option of a pistol to shoot himself. You know, so it wasn't a new thought to him. His feet had been frostbitten and rotting for days and days. He'd already asked the doctor, Wilson, several times, you know, what shall I do? Obviously hoping for some kind of a hint, like, you know, here's all the morphine, take it and kill yourself or whatever. And when he went out, he had little option, really. Jeremy Bailey, on the other hand, it was a snap decision. You know, as he remembered it, last thing he knew, he was a scientist still conducting a successful program. You know, and suddenly he realized that all he'd got left was a few minutes or maybe an hour of rather painful life, and he'd got some quick decisions. You know, and what might I have done? Might I have shrieked for Ian to come down and give some Omnipon, you know, the morphine that we all carried? You know, and Jeremy Bailey told him no. As I said, the courage necessary there, I think goes, you know, beyond even, say, Oates or anything like that. So, yeah, I was impressed.
In a small base, to lose three men has a major impact on the survivors. With 30-odd men at Halley, was the impact the same, or did it, because you were in different social groups, did those three deaths cause a big pall over Halley Bay, and if so, for how long?
It was about 6 weeks, of course, before we were back at the base.
Yes, of course.
So we only have to take what we heard. I heard that there was a little bit of division to some extent with some factions, you know, saying, blaming the others. You know, some who knew that the mechanics were unhappy about the tractors and saying, you know, the whole project was doomed, and others, you know, I think there was a bit of a first year, second year division there. And for that reason, I mentioned that Rod Rees-Jones found that map. He a first year and I a second year, of course, at the time. But even so, we agreed that we would not tell anyone, and we didn't. Because for fear of stirring up divisions, resentments, whatever, which with luck had faded away.
Somebody had to do the work that Di Wilde had done all over again, didn't they? Was that a difficult task?
Well, of course, it could have been all abandoned, but yes, it was. That was Jeff Lovegrove and Tony Haynes, who now calls himself Patrick. In fact, he's gone by several different names, different base times and bases. They stayed out there. I was astonished that that was permitted, because a lot of decisions that were made around then were made overcautiously, you know, in a sense of panic. And they were allowed to stay out, just one sledge by itself out in the mountains. And they beat our, I think they were about 212 days or 215, something like that. That will probably be hard to beat nowadays without support. But yes, they had a great time, and they remapped it. And Jeff Lovegrove was an exceedingly thorough and, meticulous, accurate person. I got excellent maps from him. And Tony Haynes gave him good support. He could get on people's nerves a bit on the base, but, out there, basically, it's, you know, the same characteristic. It seemed to come out as a determination to get a job done. And they did well.
One last final point on that subject was that the BBC World Service actually announced the news of the three deaths, which surprised me when I read that. And in some respects, to hear it on the BBC makes it all the more poignant, doesn't it?
We didn't hear it that way. I'm not sure what you mean.
BBC World Service carried the news of the loss of three men.
Well, yes, but I don't know. I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. But, I mean, remember, it came from us to Halley Bay, to Stanley, to London, and from it will have gone from there to the BBC.
But then to hear the news come back at you again on the World Service.
We didn't. I didn't hear it. I don't know. I presume they did on the base. I know my parents did, and they were upset because it said the names were withheld till the next of kin were informed. But one was a doctor and one was mapping the mountains. And the last message they got from me was that I was sledging with the doctor because I shared a tent with him for the previous month. And, we just rearranged group sort of parties only a day or two before. And they wondered whether that meant me. Just one other thing, though, before we drop this one. When we got back to base, sometime afterwards, a message came down from London that the fact that Jeremy had not died instantly was to be kept secret. And the public story was that all three died instantly and we were to be sworn to secrecy. And Phil Cotton, as base leader, put this all to us, sort of when we were all in the lounge. I mean, we tended to gather there, usually on a Saturday evening, when he'd give any announcements or whatever. And I, for various reasons, thought this was a bad idea. I mean, for one thing, it showed what courage he'd got. All right, he may have suffered, but he was dead, one way or the other. Anyway, but we weren't being asked for our advice. We were being told what London had decided and done. And I kept this. And as far as I know, most other people kept that, even though it was very difficult. Because when I got back to all the other geologists from other bases, they all wanted to question me closely. And 20 years later, I was working for British Steel, and someone told me he'd seen my name in a book. And I just said, said good things. Oh, it mentioned there was an accident and you were there. Yes, I was in the area. Three people, and other people in the room were listening now. So he was just sort of explaining to them, a tractor fell down a crevasse. Three people, two died instantly, and the other guy could shout up and tell the one on top what happened. What? Who wrote that book, Which cad has broken ranks, and broken his vow? Sir Vivian, the guy who extracted the promise from us.
Yes.
And I was furious about that. And, I wrote a ratty letter to the survey, but he'd retired. And, the people then, although I got a sympathetic letter back, they got their own current problems and they didn't know about secrets 20 years ago. But the point was, for all I know, there might be some of our people who are still keeping it a secret. That was in about the mid-80s. In 2006, I met one of our guys and found he had only just found out, and he was as angry as I was. Anyway.
One final point. How are your parents reassured?
I don't know.
They somehow picked up on the fact it wasn't you.
I don't know. Perhaps the names were released. I do not know.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on. It'll be about 15 minutes of time left.
Yes.
And let's move on to slightly happier events. I want to hear about midwinter celebrations, if I may, because apparently the Halley midwinter celebrations were quite spectacular at times. And there's one year when he had a cook who was a bit accident prone. Is that correct?
Someone was. Who? I will leave history to say some other time.
Fair enough.
My first year there. The Halley Comet, our magazine, which actually in previous years, it had been produced later, it had come out in about August or so on with a struggle. But this year they decided to bring that out for the midwinter celebrations. And yes, it came out, there were balloons, Christmas decorations out, starting a few days before, a good meal. The meals always followed our standard routine. There were the guests. Usually it was for the birthday people. There were the speakers. It could be a surprise speaker. There was the loyal toast and so on. No smoking until toasted the Queen, at which everyone lit up. Cigarettes were free and most people smoked. Yes, and then it was a group who'd put on a review show for us, various topical items. And yes, it was hilarious stuff. And another benefit was that the emperor penguins started laying eggs only a couple of weeks before. And so it meant you could have sort of egg dishes included in the food because, eggs were rare items down there. Yes, that one, it all went very smoothly, and the other one was more memorable, as you say. Someone in the kitchen, perhaps he'd had a little to drink. At one point, he was pelting the gashmen with prawns that were for the prawn cocktail. I don't know if it was the same prawns that were served up later or not. I'm not a prawn eater. What else was it? Something came, was the prawns or the... with a funny-tasting sauce, or was the turkey? I can't remember. And it turned out that it was brandy sauce for the pudding had been served with an earlier one. But for me, the best and most memorable moment was when he came in with the flambéed pudding. He'd splashed brandy on it, put a match to it, and as he rushed in with the flames trailing in the breeze, there was none on the pudding, but his arms were ablaze, and he didn't seem to notice. Anyway, he retired to bed fairly soon afterwards, and the next day there were notes apologising, and opinions were divided. Some people thought that this was utterly disgraceful. Others thought, it was, you could let your hair down. I was prepared to be in that group, as long as it only happened once a year, which it did. And it made that midwinter much more memorable. And once again, we had a film and a series of shows and skits and whatever.
There's reference in the log to a balloon flight. I presume this is not a man-powered balloon flight, was it, or a human ascent?
No. Every morning at, forget what, 9 o'clock or something, the Met men would launch a meteorological balloon. With below it was what we called a sonde. This was a lightweight transmitter that sent temperature, pressure, humidity as it went all the way up. It had to get to a height of something like 20 kilometres. We mixed units. We had a complete mix there. Anyway, it had to do that, and meanwhile they measured the signals, getting the data, and the radar followed it, and until it burst, which you could tell immediately from the radar would suddenly pick up coming down. And then they calculated, they sent these to Stanley. There were a few things that could annoy the Met men more than a delay or something wrong with it, like bursting halfway up with the radar man losing it, or the transmitter going and the balloon continuing to go up. If it was humidity, if that element failed, it tended to be meaningless, so they didn't bother. But if the temperature or pressure one went really, they had to go through the whole routine again, and they were annoyed.
So what was special about the Midwinter's Day balloon?
They plotted these things out on a long chart, the pressure and the temperature and so on going up with altitude, and they coded these up into numbers, and transmitted them as a series of numbers to Stanley. And on that day, the numbers they coded, if you then decoded them and plotted them, it gave a curvaceous female silhouette rather than... Whether they actually sent the genuine ones to, I don't know.
Let's just talk for a few minutes about your dogs. You had your own team mainly was the
Hairy Breeks.
The Hairy Breeks?
Hairy Breeks, yes.
Yeah. First of all, where does the name come from?
I spent a while trying to find this, and I've forgotten the name. I've got it written down somewhere of the chap. But there was a book called The Longships by Bengtsson, which came out around that time, about 1960-ish. And one of them was reading this, and twice it mentions briefly Ragnar Hairy Breeks. The action in the book takes place a generation or two later, but they refer back to him, and obviously he thought this was a good name. And it was, to me, it was an inspired one. I liked it.
Did you name them yourselves, or...? Did you inherit them?
No, you inherited. Some people renamed them. One had arrived from one of the other bases. Excuse me. We just referred to them as the Hope Bay team, but then they were allocated to Die Wild, and he called them Beatles. Well, no, I'm not sure if he did that. Somehow they acquired the name The Beatles anyway. Yeah, so.
So it was interesting that you were in that kind of in-between period of dogs and tractors or muskegs working side by side. Did you have any views on that? Did you have a preference?
Well, I liked the image. It was the romantic side in me, you know, the doing it the old way. And the machines were... The tractors and muskegs were powerful. We had a couple of motor toboggans. They were dreadful. They were unreliable. Mm-hmm. They did perform some service, but virtually every trip that they made out from base, when they came back, they needed major repairs. And, you know, quite often they had to be towed back by a muskeg. They were just too flimsy in those days. We had these arguments. I mean, we argued about everything over winter. And, you know, Jock Thompson, one of the mechanics, you know, he was strongly for machines. The machine will always win because it is inexorable. And, well, they weren't entirely. What you really needed was the state where either they were more reliable or where you'd got something like air support where you could deliver spares and the like. And, in fact, basically that's what happened. You know, they became more reliable. Yeah.
Sometimes men form quite strong bonds with their team of dogs, don't they?
Oh, yes. yes, you know, coming back, I find that I wasn't a dog man. I'm a cat man, as you can see. because no dogs would really match up to them, to the ones I'd had. And, you know, to me, they were the best team there was. Even though in the second season they let me down. They were a disappointment, but they were older. Yes, oh yes.
Well, how do they disappoint you? Were they less willing?
They wouldn't pull. They were reluctant, and when they did pull, it wasn't as well. But they were an old team, and in fact, they were older by more than a year because one of the youngest ones died over winter and had to be replaced by one that had been pensioned off a year before. So, yes. The
leader was Bodak.
Bodak.
Bodak. Male or female?
Male.
Any characteristics that you remember?
He enjoyed the perks of being a leader. You know, you allowed him to get away with various things. He certainly didn't, he wasn't happy with inexperience. He needed to know who was boss. But if he knew who was boss, yes, he was good. Another odd thing, if you touched him, he would go completely limp and just collapse. We knew this at various times, and once, just out of boredom one evening at a camp, we went around trying to see if we could get any of them to sit up or teach them to do so, and we got different reactions. There were some of the tough ones that just growled and said, look, you know, I'm going to pull the sledge, but I'm not acting a fool, and we left them. Some of the younger ones just got excited and thought it was a game and sort of scrabbled around and did nothing. And Bodak, you know, we tried to sit him up, but as soon as you laid hands on him, he just went flop down.
You left British Antarctic Survey in 65,
yeah,
66, I guess.
No, I got back to Britain in early 66, and then I spent about 3 years in Birmingham writing up my results, which were published as a scientific report. I used them as a thesis and got a PhD.
Well done.
Thank you.
What happened next in your life? Because you ended up a British Steel.
yes. Each year they recruit new, fresh people, and obviously, you know, others who have finished have to leave at the same rate. And so after my getting the degree, I looked around at jobs, and originally I'd pictured going somewhere where there was more geology and mining, Canada, Australia, something, maybe South Africa again. And but by then I'd married someone local, and she wasn't leaving England. So I looked around there, and British Steel, that seemed to be something along the... It wasn't geological, but it was dealing with geological materials, iron ores and that kind of thing. And yes, I joined up. I found that a colleague was Dennis Goldring, who'd been on the peninsula nearly 10 years earlier. And I stayed with British Steel until I retired through its various changes and one or two moves.
Lewis, thank you very much indeed.